Welcome back to Inside the Bar, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, a 29-year veteran prosecutor from Savannah, Georgia. As we look at the retrials of the murder of Michael Polite at the hands of Maurice Bentley, I finally got a chance to talk to career prosecutor Jenny Parker about her philosophy as a prosecutor, what it takes to try a murderer for a fourth time, and how to dig in and find the strength to keep going. Take a listen. All right, welcome back to Inside the Bar, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, and I'm so excited to have on with me Jenny Parker, who I've been trying to get on the show for what, 2 years, 3 years?
About that, I think so, yeah.
And so I'm really, really thrilled that you're finally able to come on because of your change in circumstances, which we can discuss or not discuss at your, you know, however you want to handle that. But I wanted to start because, you know, we've tried several cases together. You've had some very high profile cases here in Savannah, and, you know, a lot of, you know, your background is very, very specialized too, and you've done a lot with domestic violence, and this case isn't just that. It's got some other elements to it, but it's got some of that as well. And so your training is really very important here, and I think that that is something that we need to delve into a little bit. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about your background?
Sure. So I came to the DA's office in Savannah in 2000. I had practiced for about a year in another circuit before I came here. And from 2007 until, I guess, 2021, I handled special victims cases, a variety of special victims cases. So a lot of my training involves domestic violence, sexual assault, crimes against children. And of course, the case we're going to talk about, I ended up with because I was handling crimes against children. Even though our victim wasn't a child, it's that caseload that I ended up with this case.
Right. And so, you know, I feel like you are likely, and I do this some, but I think you probably do it more than I do, to downplay a little bit just how extensive your experience is with this. And you know, how much training and how much training you do for other agencies and stuff like that. I'm going to put it out there. You are now with me in the Western area, not in Savannah anymore.
Yes.
And I'm hoping that some of that knowledge base that you have is something that can be shared with some of the agencies out there, because I think it is really very important. So tell the listeners a little bit about that very specialized area of prosecution, because it's not as, you know, people just think, oh, it's a criminal case, you just try it, like it just comes in the door and it's fine. This kind of case, the special victims cases, are harder.
Special victims cases really are tough. And with even within special victims cases, you have to have training to handle the different kinds of special victims cases. A domestic violence case is very different from, say, a child sexual assault. But I guess the most important part about special victims training is learning how to deal with the victims who have been through a particular kind of trauma. And, you know, we referred to it, you hear it called trauma-informed investigation, trauma-informed prosecution, so that we're aware of the trauma and we don't re-traumatize victims even more in the criminal justice system, which, I mean, it's impossible to avoid completely, but the goal is to minimize it as much as possible. So, for example, if I were prosecuting a sexual assault case with an adult sexual assault victim, I only have them tell me the story of what happened one time. And that's it. With a child, depending on the circumstances, because we can get in child hearsay and children will have already had a forensic interview with someone trained to do forensic interviews, I may not even have a child tell me what happened to them before the trial, depending on what happened and their age. Sometimes we just sort of prepare them for what it's like to be in trial and to testify, but I don't actually ask them to tell me what happened. So things like that, that are really different from, you know, an armed robbery victim. You don't hesitate to have an armed robbery victim come in your office and tell you from beginning to end exactly what happened to them, even though that can be traumatic too. Obviously, having a gun stuck in your face is something that can definitely cause trauma, but it's a different kind of trauma. And I think being a special victims prosecutor for so long probably made me sensitive to just all victims, crime victims in general, and what they suffer.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. There's a lot of empathy in your approach to just about everything that I've seen. You know, I think that that has served you very well. Obviously, you know, we're coming out of a trial we had the opportunity to do together. I'm excited about that, but we're not going to talk about it because this is not the proper time. But it is hard. And you walk into these dynamics, particularly in special victims cases, where there's so many trust issues and everything else. And I think, you know, it does translate. And it's a skill set I've tried to pick up on from working with you and from, you know, Isabel and from other people that have a lot more experience than I do with that specific skill set. But I think that when you start getting into like gang cases, there's a lot of similarity there. There's a lot of almost this weird symbiosis involved in that has a lot of overlap, really. You know, that sense of family that people get from being in a gang can have overtones of domestic violence too.
And the fear. You know, the fear that victims and witnesses have when they're close to the people who hurt them, you know, that can happen in gang cases too.
Sure. Or in any case, but it is really a very, and the level of violation involved in special victims cases is often unique and terrifying. So, Yeah.
I went to a training one time where the instructor asked all the people in the training, and the training was prosecutors, police officers, to imagine what it would be like to have to describe a sexual experience to a room full of strangers. Just a consensual sexual experience, how horrifying that would be to have to sit in a courtroom and describe blow by blow, body part by body part, what happened, and then add on to that the trauma of it being something that someone did to you that wasn't consensual. And then you can sort of start to imagine what it would be like for a sexual assault victim to have to testify in court. And when you think about it that way, that's horrifying.
Yeah.
It's horrifying.
Yeah, it is. It is. And you know, it's the kind of thing that until you like take a beat and really think about it, you know, a lot of people are like, la, 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 you know, they just don't really think about what that means. So yeah, I think that is, and you know, all not, well, there are parts of that that come into play here, not necessarily sexual, but there are definitely a lot of special victims things that come into play in this case with Maurice Bentley. But so you did this work for a really long time. You and I were assigned, as you reminded me, as trial partners.
Yes. When MCD was born, we were technically trial partners.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, the thing is, as a special victims prosecutor in major case, you were kind of like a unique unicorn in our courtroom. Like, you know, there were three normal prosecutors doing major case work, like the armed robberies and the murder.
I was the weird one.
Yeah, and you're proud of it. But yeah, you had our courtroom, and then I think it was it Isabel that had the other courtroom, and then it was Frank, or was it Frank then Isabel? I can't remember.
Different people.
Mm-hmm.
Over the year. But yeah, so Isabel and Frank, I did split that caseload with them at different points.
Right. And Emily, bless her, Emily Puhala had the whole child caseload at right. that point in time, I think, when MCD started.
Yes.
So, yeah. So she had, but she had not just MCD cases. She had like all the child cases, I think.
Yeah, at different points, you know, I think they've moved some of those cases away from her because it's just a huge caseload for one person to have.
Which is terrifying when you think about it. Like
to get to the case we're going to talk about, Maurice Bentley. So that case was not obviously a crimes against children case, but Maurice had a history.
Right.
Which made him a part of that caseload. So that's how it ended up with Emily and then with me.
Well, we get to talk about his history now. Like and as the kind of thing that jurors just don't understand is that there is so much information that we aren't allowed to talk about in the courtroom because, you know, there's a presumption, especially with the kind of history that he had, of prejudice. That like the second someone hears that he was convicted of rape and incest and just all of these things, they're going to be like, bad dude, he needs to go away.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's kind of a good reason that we don't let jurors necessarily hear everything. Because then the facts of the case that we're actually trying might not be as important to them. So.
Right.
So Emily had tried this case once, and it's a great case. So a homicide that happens in front of three witnesses who are cooperative and actually saw what happened and were willing to tell the police about it. Like you don't get cases like that. People don't typically commit homicides in front of an audience.
True.
You know, and sometimes when they do, the people that happen to see it for understandable reasons are reluctant to tell the police about what they saw. But we didn't have that here. We had three people who witnessed it, one of whom was shot herself in the leg. And so Emily tried this case and got a hung jury.
That was kind of bizarre. What was your take on that?
I thought it was just a fluke. So it happens sometimes because none of us know what goes on in the jury room. You know, we do our best to pick juries, but at the end of the day, it's 12 strangers and we don't know what they bring into the room with them. And so even though it was an incredibly strong case with lots of evidence, something happened in the jury room. You know, you never know if they got confused about the law or if some fact was not clear to them or what happened, but I thought it was a fluke. It happens sometimes. And I thought that, you know, I'll try this case again and it's the evidence is overwhelming. This won't be a really difficult trial. And I got hung jury number two.
How did that happen? So I think, you know, this is a case, the only thing that was even remotely hard was making sure the ID was solid. And that seemed pretty solid early on, like we heard from Rob. So how does it happen that you get hung jury number two?
So this case involved, it was a semi-domestic sort of situation, even though it wouldn't technically be classified as domestic violence.
Well, tell me why.
So our victim had been in a relationship with a woman named Crystal, and the defendant was at the time of the homicide involved in a relationship with Crystal. So even though our victim and our defendant were not in any way related to each other, it involved a lot of the same feelings and sort of dynamics that you have in a domestic violence kind of situation. it was Christmas Eve, right?
Yeah.
It was Christmas Eve. And the victim wanted Crystal to stay home.
Because they had a bunch of kids together.
They had kids and they were at her mom's house and he wanted them to stay. Actually, he wanted them to go somewhere together to his.
Yeah, I can't remember all the details. I know he was like, he had come from Richmond Hill to see the kids and Crystal and they were going to do some big family something.
He wanted Crystal and the kids to spend Christmas Eve with him. And the kids were little and, you know, they probably would have been going to bed about this time anyway, but Crystal was young and wanted to go out. And so there were words between the two men and the defendant just opened fire right there, right in the front yard. And killed the victim, also hit Crystal's mom in the leg. And, yeah, I mean, it's just, it was horrible, and it should not have been a difficult case.
I remember, like, some weird stuff, like, by the time that we tried it, that one of the things that seemed to be confusing, or that seemed to be important to the defense, was, like, who was standing where by the passenger side door of the defendant's car. Like there were inconsistencies between Crystal and her sister and her mom about like who was exactly standing where. And to me, that was like basically irrelevant.
When somebody starts shooting and everybody starts running, people don't remember exactly what spot they were standing in. That's normal. That's normal. And then, of course, there were some allegations that the type of gun that was involved, a 380, that Crystal herself had at some point owned a 380. And so in the second trial, there was a suggestion that Crystal was the shooter and that her family was covering up for her. And it seemed ridiculous to me, but it worked. It worked. But
you think that was the hang up?
I really do. I really think that was the thing. And so before I got ready to try it a second time, what would have been a third time for the case, Emily's once and then my and actually I think there was Emily had some other situation where there was a mistrial declared during jury selection in this case.
Yeah, that was bizarre. I think it was like Judge Walmsley was upset because people had vacation scheduled. I can't remember exactly what happened, but it was like not okay.
I remember the facts of it, but it was something that happened. And so there actually were three mistrials technically in this case before the fourth trial. So the fourth trial, I decided that I was gonna try and cut off any possible allegations there could be toward Crystal. So I don't remember if it was, I think Rob is the one that tracked down a police report where
from Bryan County or something. Yeah.
Taken the gun away from Crystal and thrown it in the woods somewhere. And so we had that. And then Kevin Rittman did some more work on the case.
I'm still hoping we've got Kevin. He said that he's asking permission. So I'm hoping that we can get Kevin on. I'm so like fingers crossed.
So Kevin, firearms examiner, did some more work on the case to help us be able to argue that the gun that Crystal had owned in the past had nothing to do with this. And also, I brought you on board.
Well, and you know, the thing is, and that was fun. And we'll talk about that in a second. But one of the things you mentioned with that police report is like they decided to try to make it out like Michael Polite might have had the gun, the victim. And so it was now like a self-defense claim. Things got weird in this case.
They did.
So, yeah, you brought me on. I think that was just for fun, though. I think at this point I was in like, you know, just the support role. Okay, sure.
No, it was not for fun. Like, I was frustrated at this point. Like, this was a very clear-cut murder case. And it was really frustrating that this had gone through this. And it was terrible to keep having to bring Crystal and her mom and her sister back to testify over and over about what had happened. I can't say enough good things about them for sticking with us through this case. And
yeah,
the victims
with
us, because it had to be so incredibly frustrating for them to keep coming to court and talking about what happened and then having to do it over again.
Well, and we haven't talked about it, and you know, we can talk about that we can talk about it now. So you had to meet with this family after two mistrials, and you know, like the first time you met with them, and you're not dealing with people that are necessarily articulate and book smart and all those things, and you can explain this easily to them. How does that go?
Well, this family really got it and understood what was going on. I mean, I know it had to be really frustrating to them, but they were more understanding than I think I could have been in their circumstances. And so I'm just grateful that they continued to stick with us and have faith in us after everything we went.
Yeah. I remember when I got into it and I met them, and I of course I'm like this complete like extra person as far as they're concerned. But I remember Crystal's mom, and she had been shot in the leg, and this was just solid. I mean, she just struck me as somebody who was not taking anything off of anybody. We're going to get this right. We're going to do it. And I think that just kind of permeated everything. I think it kind of held Crystal down, because she was having a time, I think. Did you get that sense off of Crystal?
Yeah, I mean, Crystal was young. First of all, like, Crystal is in her 20s. She was young, had this incredibly traumatic thing happen to her. And she never said it to me, but I felt like Crystal carried some guilt because of it and was struggling with that. And so it made it, I think, really emotionally hard for her in a way that it wasn't for the rest of her family. I think she blamed herself for what happened. And of course, it wasn't her fault. It was the defendant's fault, nobody else's fault.
Right. Right. But I agree with you. That was certainly a sense I got from her. And she was the person I was most worried about going into the last trial, just because
not us the last time. I was trying to talk to her, but her mom helped get her to talk to us.
Yeah, I got the sense like she was just done. She just didn't want to do it anymore. And she'd been attacked. Like her character had been run through the mud.
She'd been accused of murder.
Yeah.
She watched the father of her children be gunned down in front of her and her mother shot in the leg, and then she got accused of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it had to be absolutely awful.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was some weird sibling dynamic with her sister too, because her sister had been present for this. My recollection is that the sister had kind of tried to talk Michael Polite out of, you know, like going out and talking to and she had been, so I wasn't sure how that sibling dynamic played out. Did you get a feel for that?
I mean, I sort of felt like the sister was on Mike's side in the whole thing, you know, that she wanted Crystal to be with Mike. And I mean, you know, Mike had been a part of their family for a long time. They loved Mike.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I can understand that dynamic. And it probably caused some friction between Crystal and her sister. I don't know that for sure, but it probably did.
Yeah. I mean, you start getting like all these undercurrents, you know, you sit down with the family and you're kind of like, there's something going on here, you know, and it may be just assumptions. It may just be, you know, like a mistaken perception, but I certainly just the way people were interacting, there was tension there. So you meet with the family, you try this case again. How do you have a conversation about, hey, we got another mistrial, we got to go again?
That's where a great victim advocate comes into play, in part. But also, I mean, I really believe in just being straightforward and honest with families about the difficulties of the court system and what happens, and just try to explain things as simply and clearly as I can. And so, you know, I try to handle it that way. And then, of course, try to be compassionate and sympathetic to their feelings and their frustrations in having to do it over.
Who was the victim advocate on this case?
JJ.
Was it JJ? Oh, and she's great.
JJ, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, JJ does a great, great job. It's just, you know, there was a lot of, overlap too, because I would imagine in the fourth trial, do you have the same victim advocate through all of them? It's hard to say.
Yeah, JJ stuck with us through all of this, because I can remember she being the one to really keep Crystal with us.
Yeah, and you've got to have that kind of rapport, and you got to know how to talk to folks, and she's fabulous with that. So yeah, that's awesome. That is awesome. So gearing up for trial number four. Let's talk about just, you know, what kind of, you have a very distinct approach to how you'd like to try cases. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So I have always believed that less is more. You know, their prosecutors try cases differently. And there's some folks that are very successful prosecutors that will put up every bit of evidence that they can possibly come up with. Every witness that might know something about what happened, they're going to put them up. But my personal philosophy is just to be as simple as possible. So, I personally would not put two witnesses up to basically say the same thing. I would pick which one of them will be the better witness and go with that person. And I think that keeping things simple and straightforward is the best approach with a jury, because your jury is 12 people from very different backgrounds, different educational backgrounds. You will have people in a jury that didn't graduate from high school, and you may have somebody that has a PhD, and they have different life experiences. And so I personally think the best way to go is just to present the facts as clearly and simply as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree that, and I have seen how effective that's been for you. I have a lot of varying approaches, and it depends on the case for me, but I definitely believe in one witness per fact, if you can do it that way, because that definitely works. But you mentioned juries, and this is something where I think that you just really have good instincts in striking juries and knowing what to look for. And you, again, you've got like a really good sense of what you want. So when you're going into jury selection, how do you approach this?
So I like jurors that are, if I just got to pick, and you know, it doesn't work that way. We're not selecting jurors, we're deselecting jurors. It's kind of how we always say it. But like my ideal juror would be somebody middle-aged, married or in a long-term relationship with children and a job that they've worked at for a long time. I especially like people that are involved in the community in some way. So I want jurors that are invested in the community. And that's it.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, some cases you may think female jurors may see it differently than male jurors, but I really don't see it that way. I know, you know, there are all kinds of different theories about picking jurors, but other than sometimes I don't like having really young jurors because I don't think sometimes they have the life experience to be able to make decisions about really hard things sometimes. I just think as a 20-year-old, it's really hard to understand sometimes the really nasty things we deal with in court. I mean, it's hard enough for people with more life experience and more wisdom, but I think that in some cases, I might try to avoid having a really young juror. But other than that, I want people that are invested in the community, people that care.
You talk about like bosses. You know, you like to have at least one or two bosses on there.
Yes, because you want it when you have 12 strangers go back in a jury room, you want somebody that's going to keep the train on the tracks. Especially if you have jurors that start disagreeing, you want somebody back there to be able to take charge and say, hey, let's start at the beginning and go back through the evidence, or let's talk about this issue. Somebody that can be a leader. Yeah. To help sort of organize how they deliberate. You don't just, you know, you don't want 12 people to go back there and have a free-for-all. So but having somebody that's older, that has had some experience running or managing something, I think is great, because then you can have somebody back there to sort of keep the train on the tracks.
Yeah.
So and bosses.
Yeah, you have really good instincts for that too. Because sometimes you'll see somebody and you're like, I'm not sure about him, and I think you just kind of get the vibe really well. This case, and I'd forgotten until we started talking about it, we had a really, really good juror for us. Do you remember this?
I don't. I really don't.
Well, I didn't either until we started talking about it just now. And there was a guy who was an Army veteran. He was in his 70s, but didn't want to be excluded because he was of an age where he could have been. But he had a lot of gun knowledge, and that had come up in voir dire.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the sense that he, all this mess about, oh, you can do X, Y, Z with guns that the defense had been raising in these other trials. He was just like, no.
Yeah. I vaguely remember that now. I do. And I think that in cases involving firearms, I think it's good to have people on the jury that know about guns. You know, we have firearms examiners come in and explain, and some of them, like Kevin, are really good at being able to explain it clearly without being overly technical. But having some people with gun knowledge, I think, is helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know, I remember that y'all had talked about, you know, gun knowledge. And I think you had some very good questions, but I can't remember exactly how they were phrased. I always borrow like other people's phrasing when we're doing jury selection.
Of course, you know, there's one other thing to bring up about this trial too, and that is the defense attorney.
Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Bill Lewis. Bill Lewis is such a good guy that jurors like him and find him trustworthy and believable. Mm-hmm. And even though, you know, we know that the defense in this case was really preposterous and far-fetched. When it's coming from Bill, it's believable. I think that Bill may be my least favorite person to ever try cases against because he's so nice.
Yeah, he will nice you to death, that's for sure. I tried a bunch of cases with Bill and always, you know, gentlemanly, you know, kind, funny, just, you know, overall good guy. I think, you know, and you talked about that in the context of this case. I remember, now that you mention it, in my closing, he had said something about, you know, help me out with this. He had been like constantly asking the jury to help, right? And so I was like, not your job to help either side. You're not here to help Mr. Lewis. He's a good guy, but no. Because and you have to, because he just is, he's one of those like neighborly kinds of guys. You help him out, right?
I much prefer trying cases against people who are rude and aggressive because I'm nice. And I would much rather them be rude and aggressive. And I'm the nice one. I'm the reasonable one. But I can't do that with Bill because Bill is nice and reasonable too.
I am not nice or reasonable. And it's fun. I think that's one of the good things about the two of us trying a case together. And you know, you can see it in a lot of different dynamics. But with certain witnesses, you need to be more aggressive. With certain topics, you need to be more aggressive, or at least I do, or just objections. You know, I know I'm annoying about like stuff like that, but I'm really like into like making the record, you know, read the way I want it to read. And you are so good at like lulling people into false sense of security. And just being, you know, the nice, reasonable person and making the other person look like they've lost their mind.
Yeah, I mean, it works for me because it's, I mean, it's my personality, you know, it's not, yeah. When I have done like trial training for younger attorneys, which you know, we've done some of that together. I try to tell people, you know, it's okay to emulate other attorneys, but when you do it, don't pick somebody whose courtroom style is completely different from yours. It won't work and it'll seem fake.
Yeah.
So you have to, I mean, especially when you represent the state and you're a prosecutor, your job's to seek the truth and to tell the jury the truth about what happened. I think that it's really, really important that you are yourself in front of the jury. You can't seem put on. You can't seem fake. It has to be genuine. And it should be genuine because if you don't believe in a case, of course, you have no business prosecuting it.
Correct.
So I think it's really important to be who you are.
I agree with that. I think it is a great thing to teach younger prosecutors. And when you mentioned that, you know, back in the day, and this show, we've talked about back in the day a lot, this like huge spectrum that we had in major case even of personalities. I mean, you've got, you know, there's the prep element of it. And I always talk about like, you know, there are people that like prep until like they have everything written down. And I'm closer to that end than the other end, but like a Greg McConnell. I mean, McConnell has got like every single thing.
You know? McConnell will know what the defendant's third grade teacher thought about him.
Right. He's got pieces of paper for everything.
Yeah.
So he like is super, super, super prepared. But we also had back then Jerry Rothschild, who would just literally like pick up a file and walk into the courtroom and just like do something that like comes across as brilliant because he's got good instinct. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, there's this whole spectrum of, you know, and that's the prep element, but there's a lot of personality elements that go into this. And like you're talking about, there's the niceness, there's the being, you know, soft-spoken or being bitchy and aggressive, you know, which would be me. But you know, there's like, And then there's like Matt, who is very dynamic and very, you know, like he uses audiovisual stuff really well. And you've got, you know, people that Tim Dean, that have like such a great, solidly American sensibility. And you've got like, you know, Brad Thompson who will yell at you. There's a lot of different things that can be effective. And to say that, oh, you have to be trained and you have to do it a certain way, I think is just a mistake.
No, I agree completely. I mean, you have to know basic things. Like you have to know how to prove the elements of a crime. You have to know how to put in a piece of evidence the right way.
Call a forensic examiner, like, I don't know, call your medical examiner.
You need to know like all the basic nuts and bolts, but then beyond that, how you try a case is so individual. And talking about how there are people that can say really like flippant, sarcastic things in court, like Tim Dean's a master at it on cross-examination, and I couldn't do it. And I've always told people, do not try a case like Jerry, because unless you're Jerry, you can't do it. And right. I say the same, like, if you're a new baby prosecutor and you watch Tim Dean do a cross-examination, do not do what he does, because he always asks one question too many, but he knows when he can do it and when he can't.
Right.
And until you really have a feel for that, it is such a dangerous thing to do.
Absolutely, because you could open yourself up to God knows what.
You never know what you're going to get. But that's, I mean, one of the joys of doing this job all these years has been the amazing people that I have worked with, and getting to see the brilliant things that people do in the courtroom. And, you know, that sense of, you know, especially in major crimes, that sense of we're all fighting the good fight for victims that have really been harmed. There's just nothing like it.
No, there is. Yeah, and I've talked about this before, but I know you feel it, you live it. It is a calling, and it is not something that you just pick up and put down either. it's because you care. And I know that that is something that you have ingrained to just, you care about victims and you care about getting it right. And, you know, just all of those things that people should want in the people that do this job. And, you know, you mentioned too, I feel the need to mention Isabel, because her style is completely different too. I mean, and here is a woman who can put all of these very highfalutin sounding quotes into a closing argument, which I would never, I don't quote anything, but
no, she may either.
It's organic for her.
The tell us cute story or throw in a quote kind of thing. It's just, it's not natural either, but she's fantastic at that.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there's so many different styles out there. All of them are effective and all of them, you know, are important. And to acknowledge that they can work. So you don't think that because you're one kind of person, you're more of an introvert or less of an introvert, that you can't do the job. It's got nothing to do with that necessarily. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You and I are both introverts who are trial lawyers.
Yeah. Which, you know, that's counterintuitive on so many levels.
It is. You know what? You know that feeling after you have been in trial for like a solid week, where you have one you started Monday morning and you don't finish it until Friday night or Saturday, and you feel like you need to go lock yourself in a room by yourself for like 2 days?
Yes. Had that recently.
Yeah. That's the introvert thing. You feel like you need to go sit in a dark room alone for a couple of days to recover from it.
Well, we are at some point, and you know, it's going to happen. We are going to talk about She and Julie. because that case 100% has that vibe for me.
Yes. Yes. So, that was a long one. Yeah.
Oh, painful. Painful. So we get into this trial, and again, it's not a big case either. It doesn't have like all this sprawling whatever. It doesn't seem like it should be that complicated, and yet it is a full-on fight. You want to talk about it?
Sure. I mean, I think that it was a fight for a lot of reasons. And part of it was because we had two prior trials. And so you have two transcripts where all these witnesses have testified before. And so if anybody strays even the slightest bit off of what they've said in court before, then out comes the transcript and they can be impeached with it. And so I think anytime you have a retrial, you automatically have a built-in fight over that, because nobody will ever testify exactly the same way twice. So that's part of the fight. And then just constantly fighting over what about Crystal's gun that she had owned sometime in the past before this happened was going to be able to come in or not. I mean, that was a constant fight.
Yeah. It just felt like everything. And of course, there were some things that were different in this trial too. So we had Judge Abbott.
Yes.
Which was different. And she had just kind of a different view, like the admissibility of that police report. I remember being mad about that, because she just put the Bryan County police report in evidence, which I didn't think was appropriate, but I guess technically it is.
I don't even remember that. I remember we used the report. There was testimony about it, but I don't remember it coming in.
It came in and I was mad because I felt like it was hearsay, but like 8038, whatever. And you know how technical I get, and it just made me mad at the time. I was different. Bill Lewis was different, because had John Rodman tried both of the cases with you, or had he, was, did you have Bill on both?
I had Bill on the trial.
Okay.
It had been Bill with me. Yeah, it was Bill. And then James Byrne helped him try it.
I remember James Byrne really had like this, and still does, I think, has this very burning desire to act like he knows and understands firearms and ballistics evidence, and just wants to attack like scientific evidence all the way around, because I guess he read some articles about it. And so I remember being unhappy about that. And I'm hoping Kevin will come on so that we can talk about that, because that came up in several cases with James. And I guess he's still doing it. Is he still doing those kinds of attacks?
I think that James really stays up on the literature about scientific evidence more than some folks do. I think he's more likely to make technical attacks on that kind of evidence, DNA, than some other people are.
Sure. And of course, when you talk about the literature, you still have to, and that was part of my function in this, is to sit down with the person who actually does the work and talk to them about the literature and what the literature actually means, and what's legit about it and what isn't. It's kind of like reading the paper these days. Some of it's accurate and some of it isn't.
Well, yeah. I mean, in every trial where you have an expert witness, it's so important to spend time with your expert to learn about the issues and know what you need to ask, because we're not experts in DNA or firearms analysis or any of the other stuff that we have to deal with. So, you got to sit down with the experts. I have had to be educated. Let's think of all the things we've had to be educated about with experts. Fingerprints.
Yep.
Michelle Shiro sat down with me and gave me like a 3-hour tutorial on fingerprint.
And I love that about her. It's like, teach me again.
Yeah. So I learned everything I know about fingerprints from her. So we had to learn about that. I've had to spend tons of time with psychiatrists and psychologists preparing for cases where there was a mental defense.
I want to talk about that case at some point, because that case, and I know which one you're thinking about, although it comes up a lot, I'm sure, but there's a specific case that I think, you know, it's come back on appeal. We're good. I would love to talk about that case, because the mental health defenses are complicated and in the world we live in now, I think more and more relevant.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's tons of things to talk about with mental health and the criminal justice system in general.
The DNA stuff, and I think that, you know, there have been so many advances in DNA technology too. So, you know, basic DNA was still fairly new early 90s when I was starting to do this, and has progressed. I mean, you have YSTR, you have all of these different systems that are involved, and I'm sure in the sexual assault universe, it becomes more and more important. But when you have multiple contributors, I'm forgetting the terminology, but there's more recent databases that they use to compare so that mixtures can be analyzed a little bit differently. And so that is something you constantly are having to learn about. Firearms ballistics analysis.
Fiber analysis, tool marks.
Yep. All of that, which includes, you know, tires, and it includes, you know, tool marks on a body. And that's where you get like Dr. Downs being just the bomb, because he knows all that stuff too. And he's so great.
Since I have handled special victims cases for so long, I've had a lot of training in strangulation. And yes. First strangulation homicide I handled, this was like 2007. I went out to Dr. Down's office and he got an anatomical model out and just taught me.
Well, I know you've taught on strangulation and you were helpful. You helped push through the legislation that made that a felony, so that people, aggravated assault strangulation is actually a thing. And so much of the statistical stuff involved in that, and I know I'm off on a tangent, and at some point we'll address that probably in the proper context, but you know, so much of that information is stuff that people don't know.
No, they just don't know. It's not. And, you know, strangulation cases, I still think we're not where we need to be in handling those. We need to do more training, keep doing training on that issue, because it is.
Yeah. Shan Sheely, I think, would be a great opportunity to talk about strangulation.
Yes, we can talk about that case and talk about strangulation.
And arson investigations.
Yes.
Get educated on all of the flammable things. So yeah, no, there's just so much, because there's so much information out there, and it is so easy to not be smart enough to ask the right question.
Right. That's why you have to spend lots of time preparing with experts.
Absolutely. Because, you know, they see a lot of angles that we don't.
They have to teach you what you don't know.
Yes. And there's a lot.
Need them to tell you what question to ask so that they can tell you what they say.
But yeah, and again, we need to come back to Norman Smart at some point too, because I got to talk about it with everybody but you.
Yeah. Okay, so we can come back to that one at some point too. I'll have to go back and list ones that you've done, so I'm not repeating things.
It's okay. I don't think anybody really minds some of the repetition, so it's okay. So Maurice Bentley goes to trial again. And Crystal gets attacked again. And I really felt like it was mostly going after Crystal this go round again.
Yes, it was. I mean, that was the really the only defense there. There's no possibility of mistaken identity here.
Right.
We know that Maurice Bentley was there.
He admits it and jail calls to Crystal. It's like, I'm sorry about that.
Yes. So, I mean, there's no possibility of mistaken identity. So, I mean, logically, the best defense they had was to try to blame it on somebody else who was there. And Crystal was the most likely person to blame it on. I mean, it was the most logical defense.
Right. Right.
And it worked somewhat. But finally, that fourth go around, I remember that the jury had gotten the case and we left to go to lunch. And I think before we even had food, they had a verdict.
Yeah. Yeah. We were at City Market, if I remember right.
Yes. And before we even had food, they had a verdict. And I can remember when we tried it that time in my closing argument, I kept getting this feeling that the jury wasn't listening to me. Cause it, I mean, you kind of get a feel like when they're with you and they're paying attention. And I really felt like these people are not listening to me. And I wasn't sure if it was because they'd made up their minds. And, you know, at that point, I was at my wit's end with this case. Like, I was myself and thinking, you know, maybe this case isn't as simple as it seems. But in hindsight, of course, they were done. Like, the evidence was overwhelming. They did not want to listen to the lawyers talk anymore, ready to go back and do their thing. And right. They did. I don't know, 20, 30 minutes at most.
Yeah, it was not long. But this was, if I am remembering correctly, this was the first appearance of the word junk in your closing.
It probably wasn't the first appearance. It's just the first where other people in the office have paid attention to it.
Well, it was kind of a multi-syllabic use of junk. And it's funny because you do come across as this kind of nice, soft-spoken person, but you get into closings, and I've seen this happen with you a number of times. You get into a closing and all of a sudden it's like, you can say it. This is just...
It's junk. It is junk.
I think by that point you were a little worked up too and you were kind of yelling at him.
My accent gets thicker when I get a little wound up. And I mean, my accent's still fairly thick as it is, but when I get wound up and emotional in a closing sometimes, I start to sound even a little more country. So, you know, when I'm talking about how the defense is junk, it comes with a few extra syllables.
It was classic. It was absolutely classic. And of course, the jury got it. They agreed.
They got it right. So, you know, when you know you have a good case and you know you're doing the right thing, you got to keep going and not give up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that is I think that it is easy to get disheartened, especially these days. You know, you start to hear all of this community static and, you know, the media and all these other naysaying, whatever. Oh, you sure you want to do this? And, you know, when it comes down to it, the truth's the truth, right?
The truth is the truth. The truth is the truth. And when a life has been lost, you just don't give up. I mean, no. It's the worst thing another human being can do to a person.
Well, and it's something that our community almost uniformly is going to be willing to take a stand on. And of course, you know, you can have all of this static about all kinds of other different crimes, but when you take someone's life, there's accountability. There should be. And I think that you know, the community understands and wants that. I mean, it is so necessary to have a sense that the system works, right?
Yes. Yes.
And yeah. Oh, God.
It took us a while to get there, but it did.
Yeah.
And thank you, the fourth and final time.
Yes. Yes. And it was upheld on appeal. Hallelujah. And yeah, did you run into Crystal? I seem to remember. I know Rob ran into her a couple of times. Did you run into her after the fact?
Okay. I think it was Rob. Rob saw her after
that. Yeah. I mean, just wow.
Hope she and her family are doing well now.
Me too. Me too. I mean, you can't imagine how much that loss is to, you know, a family, and to have them, you know, be disappointed over and over and over again by the system. It's just nerve wracking. It's really, really difficult. So I was grateful to be present for that one. You know, you have invited me to be present for a number of cases that I've been very grateful to be involved
in. That's say it that I have invited you.
Impressed into service. No, because that's part of what I want to talk about with some of these cases is that, you know, we had such a good group of people and all of us could do it on our own. I mean, I think all of us had tried cases on our own and continue to do that. But you, that idea that if you need help or you just need, you know, somebody else to bounce ideas off of, that everybody was there.
Oh, yeah. You know, trying a major crime case is not easy. It's exhausting. And so, you know, when you're doing something like that, it's much better to have a buddy.
Exactly. Someone that you don't you already have like a shorthand with, like you don't have to explain. Like I know this has happened to me. I don't know how many times you come out of court and you're complaining, bitching about whatever happened in the courtroom. And you to have to start from scratch. This case is about blah, 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 blah. And it's nice to have somebody who's like, you already know, and we're just complaining about the same thing.
And it, you know, it's mentally exhausting because you can't let your mind wander when you're in court. You have to pay attention every single second that you're there. And so it's mentally exhausting. It's physically exhausting because most of us don't sleep or eat well when we're in trial. And these kinds of cases they're emotional because you're dealing with tragedy and with hurt and pain, and it just helps to have somebody there. I can remember one time I was trying a case with Brad and I got so angry at a ruling from the court that I was on the verge of losing my cool, which is unusual. Like, I think I keep it pretty cool even when things aren't going my way. But I can remember saying to Brad, I need you to argue this because I just can't write this minute. Like, I need you to take over. And so
I'm pretty sure I know which case you're talking about.
I'm not going to say because, you know, I don't want to be being critical. But it was really frustrating. And in that moment, I was really frustrated. And so it's nice to have somebody with you that you trust that you can kind of tag in and say, hey, can you just take over for a minute?
Right. So I don't lose my cool and say something I shouldn't. And yeah, I think we've talked about it even recently. So much of my energy is, you know, put into not cursing, not saying what I'm actually thinking, and that sometimes like the better responses get lost because you're just trying so hard to like not lose your cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I can totally see that. So yeah, I think this has been really, really fun for me. Is there any takeaway that you think that people should take from this case from Maurice Bentley?
Don't murder people.
And we don't give up, damn it.
The state never rests.
Yeah. That's right. We're going to run it down. We are going to keep running down.
They never, you know, you're doing the right thing. You just got to keep on going. Sometimes when it's really, really frustrating and you keep having obstacles thrown up in front of you, when you're doing the right thing and you know you're doing the right thing, you got to keep going.
Yeah. Well, I am
tough spot. Ask your friends for help.
Always a good choice.
Ask your friends.
Always a good. Yes. Yes. So I am just ecstatic that you were able to do this with me. I'm looking forward to putting you and Rob on the same Zoom. And I'm hoping that we're not going to get this kind of like bumpiness that we've had this time out. And I'm not sure exactly what's causing that. But I'm looking forward to doing that. And we are going to have to do other cases. It's going to happen.
All right, let's do it. I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know some of this recording was a bit rough technically, but Jenny's perspective on trial strategy, especially in the context of a special victim's retrial, is invaluable. I look forward to our possible episode with firearms examiner Kevin Rittman on this case, and to having Jenny and Rob talk about why getting justice in a case like the murder of Michael Polite was so important to them and to our community. Stay tuned. Thank you.